All right, welcome to the fourth podcast of the Downstairs Care Out There blog podcast. My name's Mitchell Thomas. Today I'll be interviewing Jess. You may know her as EMS_junkie from Twitter. All right, Jess, now if I can just pry you away from your conversation with Minla Kong for a second, I'll get you to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jess Morton. I'm a undergrad student paramedic in I study through Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. However, I live in Western Sydney, right below the Blue Mountains.
Lovely, lovely place in the world to live. So, Edith Cowan University.
Yes.
What's that like?
Well, I'm actually quite new there. I started at Central Queensland University, but due to family commitments and not being able to travel for residentials as much, I actually transferred to ECU this year. The curriculum is really good. It's quite clinical focused and quite focused on what the job of actually being a paramedic is. It's challenging, and so far I've got a really good vibe about it, and they've got a really good SPA society there. They've got the Western Australian Student Paramedic Society, or WASPS, which are linked to Student Paramedics Australasia, which I'm on the National Executive Committee for, so it's quite cool to see them really charging ahead with what they do.
Wonderful, wonderful. I mean, I remember back when CSU first created our first Student Paramedics Association. It was literally 50 of us in a bar, and we ran it through a Facebook group. That was pretty exciting times for us then, because we didn't have a formal paramedics group before that, and they do some really good things for student paramedics. If you're not a member, I'd definitely recommend getting your membership, because they put on some quite good events and a fairly good conference every now and then.
We do. We've got our amazing annual conference coming up in September this year. And I guarantee from insider information, it is going to be the best it's ever been. We've got some amazing speakers that we're charging after. And for the first time ever, actually going to do workshops, just like the big conferences. So it's a really good opportunity to actually get your hands in and learn from the best in Australia and also from around the world. Yeah, the societies are fantastic.
Wonderful. So how long have you been an EN for?
I did my nursing straight after school. Basically, within 2 months, I did my traineeship at a big hospital up on the Central Coast of New South Wales. That was back in 2005. So I'm coming on to ninth year at the moment. Next year will be my big 10 years anniversary. However,
yay,
I have no lawn service leave. So I know.
The disadvantage of being a casual.
It is. I've been quite fortunate in what I've done in the last 9 years, because I've done a bit of everything, really. And as soon as I finished, I went to and did a course through the College of Nursing in emergency nursing. And I've had the opportunity to work in some really amazing places around Australia and really pick up some extra skills that has allowed me to have a more widened scope of practice than the traditionally. And
awesome. So having all that background, that 9 years of nursing, all those extra qualifications, what made you decide to make the jump to the dark side of pre-hospital care?
Dark side. Doo-doo.
Come with me in the ambulance and together we rule the streets of Sydney.
Yeah. I guess I'm not really a massive Florence Nightingale, traditional, well-spoken type. And I get frustrated being in the same four walls every day. And even though most of the last 9 years I've worked somewhere different almost every day, but I liked the opportunity to actually be in a car, to drive around, to, you know, where every patient could be. You just don't know what you're attending. You know, what comes down in the MDTs is nothing. You know, it's normally completely the opposite. And I think that's quite exciting. I like that freedom. I did do a gig for a while I did inter-hospital transfers, and I escorted either AMBOs or PTOs on LON patient transfers around Sydney, the state, and, you know, even just local ones. And I just really enjoyed that. And I liked the handover and seeing how other people do things and that kind of one-on-one time with patients. It wasn't necessarily acute care, and I only did it for a little while because I got a little bit bored. But I guess going into the idea of being a paramedic, I get to combine what I did enjoy there as well as doing the acute stuff and learning more about critical care and patient assessment, and I guess also trying to change the culture of things a bit.
Nice. I mean, that's definitely the thing I love about being in pre-hospital care, is that everything's different and I'm always out there. I never get stuck in the same room. I don't like having four walls around me. I don't like arriving at work in the dark and then leaving again in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, I like to work my 12-hour shift out and about and actually out in the sun and,
yeah,
you know, doing it that way. I'd much prefer that to sitting in an office or working through paperwork like I used to do.
I can guarantee my poor mentors, when I was on placement in ACT earlier this year, I'd drive them nuts because I hated having to go back to station every time we didn't have a job. and I'll be just driving in the driveway and the gates will be slowly open and going, come on, please, come on. I don't care if it's a fraction north or a nursing home transfer. I don't care. I just want to get back out there and do it. I just want to
do something.
Yeah.
You were talking about your placement in ACT. How was that?
It was amazing. I'd heard a lot of horror stories from other student paramedics from around Australia. And
I think everyone just perpetrates those horror stories, though. I've never had an experience that was as bad as some people spell out placement to be.
No, that, I mean, most people, I think, really enjoy it. It's a great time. But some people are bullied on placement, and some people will come, they might bump heads, you know, might be personality clash, or they might be cautious and quite nervous. And I really couldn't have asked for better mentors. And I had a wonderful time, and they were really supportive and cooperative. And, you know, the first day, because there's only two main hospitals in ACT and only one main public guest trauma referral centre, you know, standing out in the ambulance bay when there may have been six ambulances there, and I didn't know a lot of the other crews, obviously, and they would all actually just come up to me and go, hi, you're new here, I don't know you, I don't know your uniform, where are you from, like, you know, what year are you, where do you live, and they, oh, you know, I hope these guys aren't giving you too much slack and all that kind of stuff. And, oh, did you bring the chocolate cake? Because apparently you don't buy your mentor's coffee now. You actually have to bring chocolate cake on the first shift.
Yeah, that's a rule. If there are any student paramedics out there listening to this coming to my station, chocolate cake is a must.
Or a fail.
Yeah. Or I'm just not going to write your report. That's how it's going to work.
So I'm lucky for my paramedics. It wasn't just like the Woolies $5 cake. They were very lucky because they actually happened to be at Cheesecake Shop.
Oh, what?
Within 20 metres of the station. Oh. So these lucky buggers got
Cheesecake Shop.
They got chocolate marble cheesecake.
Oh, see?
Needless to say, I did actually pass. You know, I got a pass. So
chocolate marble cake. Who would blame them? Apart from bribing your mentors with cake, How was the actual experience of ACT Ambulance? What did you find different in their protocols to what you may have actually learned? I don't know if you're how you guys study at Edith Cowan. Do you study your local protocols, or do you kind of...
Well, at the time I was actually studying through Central Queensland, so okay. I was learning the QAS protocols.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the way that they do things. So going into ACT or ACTAS, I had managed to, you know, get their protocols and CPGs, whatever you want to call them, off the internet, and had started looking through them, and also downloaded an app which gave me access to them at, you know, finger touch. And what I really noticed is that they're more guidelines.
Mm.
And that was reiterated to me from a lot of the paramedics I work with down there, that they don't have a strict protocol where you go, okay, well, if the blood pressure is this, you give this, or you need to do this. It's very much you use your brain. You've done your degree or your diploma or your intensive care program.
Mm.
You use your brain. You look at the patient, judge the patient, as opposed to going off what the number says on the monitor. And that was really good because it actually made me really think critically about what I was doing and why we were doing what we were doing for the patient, and also what we weren't doing and what was really necessary. So, as well as I think ACT being such a small state, they had a real community feel about their paramedics. They work on lines. Most of the paramedics don't actually have a permanent station that they're assigned to. And so they could do maybe two shifts at one station, the next shift at another station, another shift at the next station. And they constantly rotate through and they work on lines. And I had a couple of months break between my first 3 weeks and then my second 2 weeks. And even when I went back, you know, I was welcomed back with open arms and everyone remembered me. And it was like, you know, got the slap on the back and, hey, how are you doing? How's your Christmas and all of that? And it's a real community feel that you may not get in the bigger cities and bigger metropolitan areas because there's just so many paramedics. So
good.
Well, for example, when I was down there, one of the lines, they were actually all went away. They had their 5 days off and they actually all went away together.
Oh.
They went on a big line camp or line holiday and they took all their families. And so that's just one example of the kind of things that they do. And I was kind of a bit jealous.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Now I want a line camp.
So then they have parties and nights out, you know, where they all go and bring their wives or husbands and...
Oh, yeah. Nice. See, we really do that for stations. We don't.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Just a different feel. Yeah.
So one of the things I really, really, really wanted to talk to you about was you're quite vocal on Twitter about being a better practitioner and being particularly a better mentor.
Mm.
And you've given me a lot of advice and feedback when I asked for it on how to be a better mentor to my student paramedic. Could you perhaps give some more of that advice to our listeners?
I guess we need to understand the journey. We need to understand where our paramedic mentors sit, what concerns them, what they have at stake to be our mentor, so that if something goes wrong, it is their head. It is, you know, their badge that they will need to stand up for and account for if we make a mistake or we're inappropriate. So we come into this often quite aware of what's at stake and, you know, that we could be a hindrance to the paramedics we're working for. Like, we accept that. I guess often paramedics may not be aware of the journey that students take to actually get on placement. And this was one of the things I wrote about on my pre-hospital research blog.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that in the show notes if Alan lets us. I'm sure he will.
Yeah, I'm sure he won't mind. hey, Alan. And I guess understanding the paramedic journey, for me, being a single mum and pretty broke at the time and going through quite a yucky separation and that was causing chaos, for me to actually get away on placement, it cost a lot of money. You know, it was something like $500 for my uniform and kit that I had to go on. You have to go through a whole series of occupational health tests that you have to pay for. That's good, you know, another good couple of $100. You have to get all these documents signed and sent away and chase it up with the uni and all of that kind of stuff.
I mean, going on placement is basically a full-time job for the time you're leading up to it. I remember when I was getting ready for placement, you know, going through uni, you're able to get away with just one uniform, but when you go on placement, you need to have two or three because you're working multiple shifts.
Yep.
You know, you need to have a good set of boots. You need to have...
Yep.
And in particular, I had to go begging heart and hand to my parents and say, oh, look, I need a bit of cash, because I really hadn't accounted for what it was actually going to cost me to go away on placement.
Well, that's not even taking into the, you know, account that most students will actually get sent away from their home.
Mm.
So they need to actually find accommodation. They need to, you know, find transport. Some people in Queensland, they might get sent, you know, a good 1,000 kilometres away from their home. Like, that's a whole day travelling. And whether you decide to fly or drive, that's still a lot of money.
Yeah.
So in terms of being a better mentor, I guess it's allowing us to have that little bit of rope to move away and to do what we've been taught. But we don't want to drown with it. You know, we need our paramedics to kind of hold on to us and make sure that we are doing the right thing. And if we are stuffing up, or if we have no idea and we've got bad technique and we're just being stupid, tell us. Don't go, hey, mate, you're stupid, go away. Because that'll just deflate us, you know, immensely, and it will have really negative consequences. But, you know, if you say, okay, after the job, away from the patient, you know, debrief us, learn how to debrief a student. You know, that was something that came up in the Smack Gold Sim Wars. You know, how do you properly debrief a situation? And that was just a simulation. Every job that we attend on a placement, that's like a whole new thing that we need to debrief on. And, you know, what I would always ask the paramedics, okay, where did I go well and where did I screw up? And, you know, if there was something that they said, look, you could have maybe skipped half of those questions, they weren't really necessary, or you could have just jumped straight to doing this, I go, okay, cool, and take that on board. I guess being patient, one of the things that was pointed out to me from an intensive care paramedic who I worked with a bit was, as long as you're doing what you must do and not doing what you really shouldn't do, the patient will be safe.
Mm.
You know, as long as you're not doing stupid things that are dangerous to the patient, or not doing things that, you know, like shocking a patient that shouldn't be shocked.
And I mean, it's very hard to get things wrong. It happens from time to time. There are numerous document instances where bad stuff has happened. But, you know, it sometimes just you know what you need to be doing because you've run through that. If you've had a good simulation base at your university, we had some fairly good access to sims, some fairly good access to good feedback at CSU where we could go and run for an hour in the sim rooms and run a cardiac arrest with a paid tutor watching, or we could do something like that. So we were fairly familiar with what we were doing going into it.
I think that's something I didn't have, because I'm also a distance ed student. So I don't have access to a simulation lab. I don't have access to lecturers to, you know, swim by on my lunch break and go, hey, look, I'm really struggling with this. Can you explain it? Or, you know, talk to me a bit more about what we did in that last, you know, tutorial, etc. So I don't I don't have that.
Mm.
So when I actually went on placement, it was the first time I'd actually seen a lot of that equipment. It was the first time I'd had to use that monitor and do, you know, the morning check of the defib and all of that stuff. And it's quite daunting because, you know, I'm not used to actually having contact, you know, with other paramedics. And so where there's a lot of my counterparts around Australia who go to university every day, they do have that opportunity. So it's a completely different challenge, really.
Mm. I mean, going essentially from not having ever touched any of that equipment to having to know where everything is, you would have had to do a pretty good car check, get right on top of that from the start.
Yeah, it was pretty good. My first day, Rob, one of the guys I was working with, kind of said, look, this is what's going to be expected of you. Your job each morning will to be, you know, to check the defibrillator, to do the whole monitor check, print it out, make sure it's working. And then, you know, we would like you to do this and this if you have any questions. And it was awesome because every morning there may have been something that I didn't see in a different car. So, you know, if I was working with an IC for the day, you know, they may have extra equipment that may not be in an AC car. So I could ask about that. And if we had time, we'd open it all up, go through it, practice. And that was really beneficial. So.
And I mean, that's what the car check when you have a student is really for, is for getting them in front of that kit and pulling out each piece. And going, this is where we store this. If you need this bit of equipment, this is where we tuck it. Because there are things there that sometimes you need to find, like T-pieces or the screw-on oxygen outlet that we hide in the bottom of the bag so that it stays in one place.
Yeah.
But if someone doesn't show that to you, you're never going to be able to find that in a time of stress. Someone going, I need the thingy. I need that thing right now.
That's right.
And you have no idea where it is, so you're just turning this bag upside down.
I remember the first time I had to, I think, try and find a particular needle or something, and I just couldn't find it. And I was like, felt like an absolute idiot. I knew what I was looking for. I knew what the package looked for, but I just didn't know where the damn thing was. So, no, something else that was quite good is that when I was on station, some days we had a lot of downtime. We could have been on station for hours. It drove me nuts. There were a couple of guys that actually said, hey, you know, have you had to go with the simulation? Do you want me to do some scenarios? And where I was actually able to go and cannulate others. Nice. All the mannequins, and they would set it all up. One of the great guys, Kelly, who is also on Twitter, thanks, mate, one day pulled me over to a mannequin and said, all right, here's your patient. They've got this type of pain. And he would push me and go, okay, so they've got this. You know, and I know he was trying to head for a AAA, and it was quite stressful at first, and I felt like a real idiot. I felt really pressured, especially seeing it was just one-on-one. There wasn't anyone else really watching, but it actually really pushed me to think and gave me the confidence to actually keep working with Kelly, who I did work with a few more times. And I felt more confident working with him because he knew where I was at. And I also knew that he trusted me.
Yeah, good. I mean, watching your student can be a huge benefit. Back when I was with Defence, I used to be involved in mentoring younger medics that were coming up. And just, I had a huge amount of difficulty because I'd been a single provider for such a long time, stepping back and actually letting someone take the reins. And that really, if you haven't seen your student in action, that can be quite a daunting feeling, knowing that you're about to turn over care of a patient to them.
And it's also quite incredibly daunting having that care turned over to you. It's a different concept. I mean, like, coming from the nursing background where I was used to, you know, if a patient buzzed me and said, I've got chest pain, I just deal with that chest pain. I will go through, you know, the PQRST, I will do what the protocol says, I'll do my 12-lead, and on the way I'll let the person know that's in charge, by the way, the patient that's in this bed has got chest pain, this is, you know, such and such and such, and this is what I'm doing, I will get back to you. And so going in and, you know, knowing that I don't have a MET system, you know, I don't have a special number I can go where this whole team of ICU doctors turn up and take over, and it's like, thank goodness, is quite daunting because it is just myself and the two paramedics, and, you know, they've got different ways of handling things and they've got different expectations of knowledge than I ever had, and it's been a real learning curve. But watching your student, I think one of the other jobs I did on my very last week was we went to a car accident, and it wasn't major, it was right on peak hour, so it was kind of pressure to get in, get out, so they could clear the road. However, the guy said, okay, look, you go deal with that. That's fine. We'll just be over here. And I knew that they were within earshot. I knew that I was safe. I knew that my patient was safe. And I knew that they were just there and that they weren't going to let me do harm to the patient. So before I moved the patient, before I did anything else, I said, this is what the history is. This is what the obs are. As it was, the patient was extremely hypertensive and needed to go to hospital. The fact that they just gave me that leeway and kind of just didn't hover over me, it was fantastic. But I mean, that was also at the end of 5 weeks of placement.
Yeah, I mean, getting to the end of 5 weeks, you can really start to trust your student, and you know their ability. I mean, it just takes time to warm up to people, and especially just the different ways that people do business.
That was actually a real challenge. I never worked really. I think there was only 1 or 2 weeks where I worked with the same crew the whole week. And even then, if they got a job, because they've got the Snowy Hydro rescue chopper down there, they would often actually get sent out to the airfield if they needed to pick up a patient and bring the chopper crew back with them. And so I would get left on station or in ED, wherever, you know, we were at the time, and oh, someone else will come and pick you up. And it was a challenge because I'd often be passed on even throughout the day. You know, it was one day I had 3 different crews. And
as long as they didn't knock off and forget you. Now, there was something I was supposed to do before sign-off.
Luckily, I was staying in the nurse's quarters at the hospital, so if all else failed, I'll just, you know,
just wander back home.
Yeah, just wander back home.
Get your bag tomorrow.
But that was a challenge, actually, working with multiple people because, like, for example, you know, there were a lot of crews that liked having all the sticky dots put back on the ECG leads at the end of a job when you clean up and repack and restock, whereas there were other people that said, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that. They become all sticky and you... And that was quite stressful because you just felt like you couldn't do anything right. Yeah. And you're just like, geez, how do they like it? You know, there were other patients that, you know, wanted the blood sugar taken off the cannula. I'm beyond used to pricking fingers. And so to me, that was quite a bizarre concept. But okay, that's what I will do. Yep. You know, it's you go with the flow, so... Yep. And you just have to ask. If you're really worried and, you know, you're kind of feeling on edge around a different mentor, just ask them, how do you like to do this? I'd rather know now at the start of the shift or at the start of that my time with you, and that way I can do it how you like.
Yeah. My first teacher ever when I came into the job was a extended care paramedic with the ambulance service. So she taught me really just to, your first 20 minutes, you just stay on scene, you get the full story with a patient. Obviously non-critical, but who needs to go to hospital? You stay, you get your 12 leads, you get your first set of obs, you do everything on scene. And that, I went straight out of that to my next partner was very much the first 5 minutes, let's have them in the ambulance and we'll go to hospital. So that was a bit of a culture shock, but it's all about learning how someone else does it and just watching them. You know, spend your first 2 days on your placement just watching your mentor. If they ask you to step in and do something, step in and do it by all means.
Yeah.
But just really watch how they do things and learn by absorbing it from them. And that was how I got through placement.
It's also good. Sometimes, you know, you can also teach your mentor stuff. And it's probably not going to be, more than likely, it's not going to be numbers and figures and diagnosis and that kind of thing. I mean, that's not what we're here for. But it could just be a way that you use to get a patient to stay awake. We had one patient that was drifting out of consciousness after a traumatic head injury. And one thing I've often found is you can ask patients and rub their chest all you like and go, hey, what's your name, sir? Wake up, blah, 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 and they won't. If you ask them about their children that or their grandchildren, they go, ooh. And they, you might even get a smile while they're really sick, but they will try and tell you about them. And even if it's just enough to get, just keep those eyes open and responsive. And one of the parents said, oh, I never really thought about it. And for this patient, it worked for a little while.
I mean, that's what I like to do. I like to, whenever I pick up anyone, really like to talk about their life. I mean, there's nothing I can say to them that's going to keep them awake. I've got nothing really to add. They don't care about me, but if I can just sit there and listen to what they've got to say, you know, listen to their problems and really know who I'm dealing with, then it helps me a lot. And I find that patients are often, they'll light up with a smile when you go back and see them in ED and follow up with them.
That's a really important thing, I think, about being a paramedic. And I had started thinking about becoming a paramedic probably about 5 years ago, or 5 or 6 years ago now. And one of the things that held me back was the lack of continuity. You know, I liked the fact that I can, even if I may get sent to a different ward or emergency the next day, I can actually just duck up there and see with the patient and ask the nurses or have a look through the notes and go, you know, how they're going or what happened or how did your surgery go last night and follow up on them. Whereas as a paramedic, it's a lot harder to do that.
I mean, we find our ways. Often the ED staff will be very helpful. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the nurses around and a lot of the doctors, especially thanks to Smack Gold, will now come and chat to me regarding cases that we've brought in and what particularly interested them and what the patient's course was.
Yeah.
Which is really good. I mean, just knowing them as on a personal level has given me that continuity and that follow-up.
Yeah.
Which has been really nice.
Hmm.
So, yeah, make friends with doctors and nurses in the emergency department. You're all part of a big team of healthcare and...
I think that was actually something that Steve Carroll said in the EM Basic podcast. He did a pre-hospital one.
Oh, yes.
And he did actually give mention to the fact that paramedics really appreciate doctors' feedback.
Yep, definitely, definitely.
You know, there is often that tribalism, you know, between paramedics and the emergency department. And I think, you know, that could be diminished. Like, you don't know, the doctors often don't know the paramedics' protocols and what it is that drives them to do what they do. And I've heard this from a few paramedics now. Nor do paramedics often know what it is the emergency team do once we leave.
No, I mean, once we've put them on the bed and walked out, it's really all voodoo magic after that point.
Of course, magic.
Yeah.
But Steve Carroll had really made mention that the fact that, you know, next time you see that paramedic, pull them aside and go, hey, how was that patient presenting? And, you know, what define your choices for that patient and the treatment of care? But also give them feedback and tell them, you know, what did that CT show? Or, you know, did that x-ray show something that was completely opposite to what you were suspecting? And that can be really beneficial for our learning as students and as, I guess, qualified paramedics as well.
Definitely. And I mean, as a paramedic, you have to remember that you're the emergency department's eyes and ears out on the ground.
Yeah.
Really, if you're bringing a patient in who needs to be assessed by the aged care assessment team, maybe for placement into a nursing home or mobility aids at home, you really have to paint a good picture of what conditions that patient was living in and how they deal with their daily living activities and how they deal with that. I mean, we have the asset team from our hospital often come and chase us down in the hallways. If they know our names, they'll read the case sheet and they'll come and find us in the hallway and ask us, really, you know, oh, I just wanted to get some clarification on, you know, Mrs. Smith from the other day.
And often the paramedics, you know, you'll actually have that say, you know, if the patient's been medically cleared and think, oh, we can send them home at 6 o'clock. And, you know, if the patient hasn't documented that the house is completely trashed, that there was nothing in the fridge, that there were, you know, worms and stuff in the sink, who knows, and that, you know, the whole place is a fool's risk for that patient, that may actually define whether the patient does get sent home or whether they may get admitted for just, you know, some occupational and social work assessments to define whether they need more services or help or et cetera.
So. Definitely, definitely. And, I mean, that's one of the things we can really add in our care of at-risk people is we need to paint a very good picture of what we saw so that the hospital can make the correct decision on that patient's disposition.
Yeah, I actually have a perfect example of this. I have I knew a paramedic who attended a palliative 18-year-old girl. She was dying from cancer and she didn't actually have any services, palliative services set up for her. I don't know how, but she managed to slip through the cracks. And this girl was just, you know, she had all the prescriptions for all the painkillers, but she didn't actually have a palliative care nurse or a palliative care team that her family could call for her. And these paramedics ended up being called to her one night because she was just in extraordinary pain and she couldn't cope, neither could the family. They didn't know what to do. And they took her into emergency and she got admitted and this information was passed on, you know, obviously the emergency team, but then they went back and spoke to the DO who actually followed up with the hospital and said, you know, can we get palliative involved, you know, and even if we need to get called out to do something for her in the future, we know that there's a palliative team involved. And because of the paramedics' actions, documentation and actually following it up, she had a full palliative care team set up for her within 3 days.
Good.
And she went home. She was able to die comfortably and with her family. And
I mean, that's where our job comes back to, difference. Isn't it?
Yeah.
We're the first point of contact in the healthcare system for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But we're also the first advocate.
And you can make
the first professional advocate.
Yeah.
I mean, the patient is always an advocate for themselves in what they want, but we really provide that we know what services are available and what services can be accessed.
Yeah.
So it's our job to assist the patient in accessing those services sometimes.
Yeah.
And in asking the hospital to act on that patient's behalf.
Definitely.
We probably should have brought Foamed up a bit earlier because we were talking about distance learning, and I think Foamed would have tied very well into that, but we can just as easily add it at the end of the conversation here. Obviously, we have two very different perspectives regarding Foamed in education.
Mm.
When I went through my 3-year paramedics degree, we didn't have anything like Foamed. Yeah. We had Medline Search and the university textbook library. We didn't have champions of knowledge out there shouting from the...
Sorry, Min Lacan wasn't around.
Well, I'm sure he was around, but I didn't know of him, and I don't think... How do you think it's changed what you do as a student? Have you picked up anything from Foamed that's changed your practice? Or changed how you thought about practice?
It's changed how I think. It's enabled me to be more critically minded.
Yep.
I need a cough. I think what it's done is it's opened my eyes up to that what we do in our policy and procedures is not all that there is out there.
Definitely.
And I guess coming from, you know, public health and where it's quite policy driven, there's been a lot of red tape. I know, to actually start understanding the research that goes behind that red tape and why we do things and why we don't do things and why only certain people are allowed to do things. And, you know, I guess that, you know, brings up like the paramedic RSI debate that continues, is that, you know, what does the evidence show? And I guess through going through uni, doing the paramedic degree, I've able to type in, you know, keywords with a hashtag into Twitter and find links to free open access articles, journals, you know, podcasts, blogs, whatever else that I wouldn't have found through my uni online database.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, some of those searches are just so hard to actually get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
People will smatter their keywords with anything just to generate more results sometimes, and you won't actually be getting a paper on what you want to read, but you'll be getting a paper that somehow relates to what you want to read.
That's it.
I found Foamed a really good filter for finding exactly what I want to read.
Well, you've also got that opportunity for real-time discussion.
Oh,
you know,
definitely.
As so many have proved before us, so we can ask a question, or I can, you know, whether it, and, you know, I use Foamed through two hats. You know, I use it as a nurse and what I do at work, and then I also do it as a student paramedic. And so I can post a question, and normally within 5 to 10 minutes, I'll get a really good answer with links to articles and research and whatever else that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise get. And, you know, some of the discussions that happen are fantastic. I mean, we've obviously had the cricoid and the checklist debate and all of that stuff that just continues on Twitter, but There's so many other discussions that can take place in real time, and you can get others' opinions. And instead of just having what a textbook tells you, you're gathering a whole bunch of opinions and evidence-based, you know, ideas and putting them together. And that's where you can make, I guess, you know, an educated judgment.
Definitely. And I think that's what we need to do as students and practitioners is, obviously, just because it's made it into Foamed doesn't mean
it's
the golden standard. So you still need to be capable of critically appraising a piece of literature.
That's right.
And it's definitely improved the way I critically appraise literature. I mean, back when I was at uni, we did a stats subject, and yeah, I was like, oh, why do I need this?
Yeah.
Why do I need to know about numbers? I'm never going to be writing papers. But I found it so useful reading papers that I'm now grateful that I did that stats subject, because without it, I'd still be taking my papers to my girlfriend and asking, what do the numbers mean?
Yeah. What N means is this?
is this good numbers? Can I talk about this?
So you mean you can't actually just read the abstract and get the answer?
No. The author's conclusions are not... That's not critical appraisal of literature.
See, that's why, you know.
Damn it.
Come to Foamed, you'll learn all.
You'll learn lots. I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you're already a watcher of Foamed, because that's how most people find this, is through Twitter. I can't imagine there are many people just wandering across, unless they're looking for a review on a Leatherman Raptor, in which case you'll be sorely disappointed with this podcast. Has your background in nursing helped or hindered your studies?
A bit of both. Because I'm not a critical care nurse, I've done quite a bit of emergency care, but, you know, I'm not a resus nurse. I'm more like the other side of ED. and, you know, done lots of ward nursing, pediatrics, a bit of primary care. My two main areas that ward is like surgical and probably the high dependency medical. So in some ways it has actually hindered because I have an expectation of what is done and what we do, and also that wonderful knowledge that, you know, if the shit hits the fan, I've got that button, you know, like if my patient falls on me and, oh, they're actually arrested, I can just hit a button and I'll have a whole bunch of people turn up, and then I can scream out the door, can someone call an arrest? And I have a whole team waiting there, you know, with that's full of knowledge and knows what they're doing. I guess in some ways that's really hindered me because I'm so used to that safety net, and it's hard to shake that off.
But now you are the team.
Now you're the
team that's being called when someone has an arrest.
And that can be bloody scary at times.
Oh, definitely.
You know, when you think about it, when you need to know everything, you know, when you need to calculate the dose of adrenaline you're going to give that kid with anaphylaxis, as opposed to waiting for the doctor to turn up and chart it for you. So it does, you know, but at the same time, I think the background idea of pathophysiology, understanding what a sick patient looks like, understanding that a crying baby is generally a good one, understanding what colour and smell and taste and what something sounds like. What are you smoking at?
I was just saying, I wouldn't taste anything that came out of a patient.
So I think, you know, that idea has actually helped. And I think one thing is, you know, I'm quite used to looking up blood results and, you know, monitoring, you know, different things that come back and having to call the team and say, oh, look, you know, this patient's got an INR. So one of the examples when I was actually on placement is I was, you know, obviously I had only just got put with this crew and was only going to be for an hour. And so it was a little bit stressful. We went to a patient. She was an oncology patient. She'd previously been in hospital for a Cre-DVT, and her D-dimer was high. And I remember that. And, I mean, I know that that's not gold standard and all of that kind of stuff, but I had in front of me the whole discharge report from the hospital, all the medications, all her blood results and CTs and Dopplers and all of that in front of me. And the paramedic, I was just watching this time. I wasn't really doing anything. And the paramedic gave it to me, so, oh, can you just hold this? So I naturally start reading and read the nursing discharge, and I understood it all. And I actually, and because the lady was actually having acute chest pain that day and shortness of breath and, you know, her stats are quite low and all of that. And I actually went to him and I said, she could well be having a PE. She had a confirmed DVT, you know, which the patient wasn't able to tell the guys, but was in her report. And I was actually able to say, you know, like all these bloods are quite indicative that she could well have had a clot and be throwing off a clot. And they hadn't even read it, and I had told them, and sure enough, she did have a PE, we found out. And so I think there are certainly instances where I can draw my nursing experience into paramedic care. But in terms of being a student, I think it's made it a lot harder, you know, because what I'm allowed to do, you know, in one place is different to what I'm allowed to do in another. And, you know, the two don't always meet in the middle. And what, you know, we get taught as nurses is so different to, the culture of paramedicine. So.
Definitely. So, Jess, at the start of this recording session, we threw the question up there on Twitter if there was anything that people wanted us to specifically address about being a student paramedic, particularly, obviously, questions relating to your background in nursing going into the role of student paramedic. One of the questions that came out was, how do you feel about the statement that paramedics are glorified first aiders?
I think the paramedic degree, if you actually look at it in quite, you know, for more than 2 seconds and look at the curriculum and the scope of knowledge that is actually required now to become a graduate paramedic, it's actually really extensive. It's not an easy degree. Whilst I haven't actually done the nursing degree, I've done the EN Vision. I would kind of argue that it's actually a lot more extensive than the registered nursing degree in terms of what they expect you to know. The level of pharmacology, even though you may only have, I don't know, say 15 drugs in your scope to give, you need to know those drugs because you don't just, you know, take them off a chart, go, the doctor wants this amount given, etc. You actually have to decide the dose. You need to calculate the weight. and calculate a dose of ketamine, etc., based on that patient's weight.
It just wouldn't be a podcast without ketamine being mentioned, would it?
No, it wouldn't.
No, so that's we're two for two now.
There you go. So I think it's rubbish, and I know that most people that say it don't actually mean it. It's more a bit of a joke.
I mean, yeah, it's a bit of a joke, like people saying we're the you know, the ambulance driver.
Yeah. Glorified taxi driver.
Well,
yes, except for we've got cool sirens that make lots of noise.
Exactly. We get through traffic a little faster than taxis.
Oh, I've had probably scary trips in taxis and I have ambulances.
Okay, that's a worry.
Yeah.
You need to seriously look at your taxi company. Yeah, I completely disagree. I mean, I know when the question was asked, it was asked more in jest, but we actually have quite an involved skill set and quite involved scope of practice.
Yeah.
Initially, we started out as basically paid first aiders years ago. But, you know, with the intensive care paramedics moving more into the critical care transport and the initial stabilisation of critically injured people, we are coming closer to the medical profession side. I mean, no longer are we just walking in with a box of bandages and stretcher bearing people to hospital. We're actually providing meaningful interventions in the field.
I think if you actually kind of looked back and looked at the history, you know, of being a first aider and a first responder and how the terminology has actually changed. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, paramedics were known as ambulance officers. So, you know, it's more the old elderly that will still call them that these days, whereas paramedic is the title.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't mind being called an ambulance officer.
Yeah.
What I particularly like is being called an AMBO, like, because that's just... That's an Australianism, shortening something with O at the end of it. So it's a colloquialism, and I don't find it offensive at all. I find ambulance driver offensive.
Yeah. I think it is quite silly. What paramedics do, you know, is huge. They, you know, often, as we don't just scoop and run, we will stay and play, as, you know, some call it. What are paramedics actually doing if they're staying and playing? You know, they're using their knowledge, often 3 years of a degree plus a graduate year of knowledge and skills, and they're putting that into the practice to actually try and save a life or to stabilise a patient. Or, you know, it could just, I don't know, delivering a baby, like all of these things, you couldn't just get a normal, ordinary first aider to be able to do those type of activities.
Hmm.
So, yeah, come on, it's a bit silly.
The question that inevitably comes out whenever someone talks about paramedics, whenever you say you're a paramedic, whenever someone even hints, people ask you about the violence. And I mean, there's been a lot of concentration, particularly recently in the media, on violence towards paramedics.
Yeah.
And particularly a couple of services now are doing targeted anti-violence training towards their paramedics. Did you find that the violence deterred you at all from becoming a paramedic?
No, this was also an interesting question from Jane Doe on Twitter. She had said, basically asked if going from nursing, whether it was a deterrent, and no, it's not. I don't like to call myself a victim, but I've certainly been on the other end of several violent acts, you know, as a nurse at work, and most of them weren't in the emergency department. Most of them were on ward level. I've faced aggression incidents and threatening behaviour in a place that you would not expect it and you would think would be banned. But, you know, I still faced it there. So I don't, whilst we know that paramedics are going to be a much high risk, and, you know, evidence has shown, like through Professor Brian Maguire's research, that...
Yeah, I mean, that Brian Maguire paper we were just talking about before came out not that long ago, an occupational injury risk amongst Australian paramedics, an analysis of national data. Looks like it compared two registries, one from America, one from Australia. Put some numbers behind the serious worker compensation case amongst paramedics by mechanism of injury. By far, the highest injury to us was lifting. Muscular stress while lifting. Assaults didn't come in until well down the list. I mean, whereas close to 3,000 paramedics were injured during the course of this study in lifting injuries, we're only looking at 100 paramedics that were assaulted.
I think avoiding violence and deterring violence is a skill that's learned, and it's not something that you can just grab from the textbook. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of our anti-violence education that I've got so far has been through a psych subject, When truth be told, probably the majority of violent acts do not come from the mental health patients. It actually comes from drug and alcohol. So I think one of the ways is that we go through New South Wales Health with mandatory education is actually recognising violence and recognising and minimising aggression. And so we need to look at ways of addressing and seeing that that person or the family member or bystander may be a potential risk to us, and learning how to deter that and actually reassure people. But having said that, you know, it's not always easy to escape. I mean, I got strangled by a patient back in 2006, and I was scared, especially in a one-on-one patient. He had dementia and he had blood transfusions, etc., going, and I needed to try and stop him from pulling all his lines out. And so that was my job for 10 hours of a night shift. And, you know, as usual, I just went, no, don't do that. It's okay. You know, like, lie down, blah, 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 all the usual stuff. And for the first time, he just reached both arms up to my neck. It was about midnight, and grabbed me around the neck and strangled me. And I had no way getting away from him. I wasn't trained at that stage in how to get out of a headlock. I couldn't reach a buzzer or anything, and the only thing I was able to do is actually rattle the bed cages and bed rails and get attention that way. And that was pretty stressful. I had welts on my neck for a good couple of hours and got sent down to ED to get assessed and, you know, all of the rest of it. The poor girl that was in charge of the ward that night was beside herself. And so I don't feel that I'm at any more risk as going into paramedicine than I am and what I do now. I mean, I've had several friends that have had their wrists broken by patients. They've had syringes shot at them, like dirty needles. So I've been punched, I've been hit, I've been had chairs thrown at me. So I guess I'm kind of used to the violence now, and it's, as I said, most of it's not in an emergency department. So I'm not actually worried by it, and it's something that I'll just be wary of, I guess, coming from experience, and you know, make sure that I am up to date and aware of procedures on how to actually avoid that, and positioning. Definitely. And body language, and I guess more relating to the patient. I'm not a fan of the culture of, you know, arcing up and being aggressive back to someone that might be aggressive to you. You know, if you can relate to them and use that wonderful thing of empathy and trying to understand what it is that's actually making them aggressive in the first place and trying to avoid that.
I mean, if that's just not happening, then obviously you've always got the option to just get out.
Yeah.
And you've got a plan. Every time you walk into a house, you've got a plan to walk out.
That was actually a really interesting point that I did learn on placement in ACTAS is, you know, I remember the very first job, and it wasn't an aggressive incident, but we were going into a construction site, and, you know, the IC says to me, we go in, you watch how we go in, and as you're going in, you need to look at every single way of getting out. And it stuck with me. So, and I do that now, and I actually do that, you know, take that more so than I ever did into my nursing practice when I'm going into a room or an area where I could be at risk, and just being aware of that, and, you know, situational awareness. It's a huge thing. It keeps us safe and it keeps our patients safe so that we can go home at night.
Coming back to situational awareness, I could do an entire podcast just on situational awareness. I'd like to thank Jess for coming along today to record with me. You can find her under EMS_junkie at Twitter. She also writes on the prehospitalresearch.eu website that's run by Alan Blatt, which is an amazing website for all research associated with prehospital care. And if there's been a landmark study in prehospital care, it's probably been covered on there.
Conference on around the world.
Yeah, he's amazing. He covered SMAC like a machine. He probably didn't sleep for quite a few nights, I think. While he covered that, and his summation of the entire SMAC conference was absolutely amazing. Just put it all on one page for everyone. So, Jess, where can people find you?
Well, next two big things coming up for me this year are at the SPAR conference in September, which is the Student Paramedics Australasia. Any other students from around the world, if you want to come, please do. It's an awesome opportunity to come, share, drink, learn, do all those exciting things. And we're going to have, as I said earlier, these great workshops, etc. this year. Just before the SPAR conference is actually the Paramedics Australasia International Conference, where we've actually got a simulation challenge, and it's going to be amazing. And we've got a whole bunch of teams coming in from around the world to compete in that. Team Australia EMS will be help running that as well. So
nice. I think exciting. I put in like a terrible patient idea for that. Oh, earlier. It was a nightmare patient.
Was it to do with bacon?
No, it had nothing to do with bacon. Okay. It was a, what was it? It was a pregnant, unconscious, asystolic car crash.
Oh, yes.
38-year-old female or something. It was, yeah. I think,
is she Jehovah's Witness too?
Probably. I think I just turned everyone off actually turning up to the sim challenge there, just on the off chance that they may include that.
It's a great one to turn up and to watch, but probably not the best one to compete in.
I think so. It's nice to see simulation being done by people who are passionate about it, and they show you can have a little bit of fun even while you're doing your simulation. Apart from your writing, your Twittering, your attending conferences, is that it for you?
Well, I'm pretty much a 24-hour mum.
Okay.
Two little boys. I've obviously just gone back to work. I'm on the casual pool now at a beautiful hospital right in the Blue Mountains, which I, you know, it's like my family home almost. What am I said? I'm going to be working on a new project coming up later this year to do with sepsis, but I'll keep that one a little bit secret.
Keep that one under wraps until it comes out.
Yeah.
I'm sure that'll be exciting when it does.
It will be landmark and changing.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, secret stuff, I'll tell you after.
Secret squirrel business.
Yes.
Okay, so for the Downstairs Care Out There podcast, this has been Mitchell Thomas. You can find me at JRParamed on Twitter or via my website, Downstairs Care Out There. You can obviously find this podcast through my website or through iTunes. If you subscribe to iTunes, you will get the podcast when I upload it, as opposed to when Apple shows it in the iTunes store. So if you could subscribe, leave me some feedback, give me a rating. If you want to hear anything discussed, if you want to come and chat to me on the podcast, get in contact with me. I'm very keen to have paramedics from all over the world. I'm very keen to listen to anyone who's got a story or an idea to share. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch up with you next time.